I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. According to a new Pew Research Center poll, 98% of scientists believe that humans have evolved over time compared to 68% of the public. 87% of scientists and 50% of the public believe that climate change is caused by human activity. And on an issue in the news lately, there's a divide over vaccines, with 86% of scientists and 68% of the public who believe that vaccines should be mandated. What explains this divide over such important issues? What differentiates those who accept and those who doubt scientific research? And why are deeply held personal beliefs so impervious to facts and statistics? We have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Joel Achenbach is a writer for The Washington Post, author of the National Geographic magazine's March cover story, Why Do Many Reasonable People Doubt Science? Joel Achenbach, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And also joining us and by telephone is Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. His research focuses on personal beliefs and misperceptions. He's also a contributor to the New York Times Upshot. And Brendan Nyhan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Joel, let me begin with you. It seems there's always been some degree of suspicion about science. Do you think it's more common, more prevalent today?
Well, science has been telling us things that are counterintuitive or that some people don't want to hear since science was invented. I mean, go back to Galileo and in the Copernican model of the universe. That caused a lot of dismay, and Galileo was, put under house arrest and forced to recant that, even though it was true. And certainly Charles Darwin delayed his theory of evolution going public with his theory for a couple of decades because he knew how upsetting it would be to a lot of people, including his very devout wife. And so science is, it always has generated controversy and pushback. And, we in our lives, we know people who believe in fringe theories. Things like, UFO visitors or Bigfoot, things like that. But what's happened lately is there's a lot of issues that are really important to what we do in the future as we try to manage a planet that is technological. It's got 7 billion plus people. What are we going to do about climate change, for example? It's a really big issue. And so the stakes are in some ways higher now maybe than they used to be because of these big policy decisions. There's a lot of technological questions that people didn't have to worry about 40 years ago. When I was a kid, they didn't have genetically modified food, so that we didn't have to make a question about GM foods out of a laboratory. That didn't exist then. There's a lot of things that exist now that did not exist in previous generations, and there's tough questions we have to answer.
Do you see, Brendan, it similarly in that we are in a world that is so much defined and I guess in many ways driven by science and technology, and as Joel writes in his piece, we want to understand the world that we live in. We want to see cause and effect, but it can get us into trouble.
Well, that's right. We've certainly become a more polarized society. So for those issues that involve matters of science that become linked to politics or culture or religion, we can get these very sharp divides. It's important, and I think Joel is absolutely right to point out that science has always been controversial when it's touched on these areas. That part isn't new. It's also important to point out that people still say overwhelmingly that they trust science. The overall opinion of scientists that Americans hold is very positive. It's just these specific issues where science has become linked to sensitive matters of identity that we see these sharp divides. So I think it's important to think about this not as something that extends across science, because there's all sorts of scientific domains where there's very little public controversy. It's these specific issues, like the ones we're going to talk about this hour, that are more polarized.
Well, and just picking up on that, and Joel, going back to you, and you mentioned Charles Darwin, and I was quoting from the Pew Research Center poll finding that, you know, almost 100% of scientists believing that humans evolved over time compared to 68% of the public. That's a big divide. That's a big gap there.
Well, it's as Brendan just pointed out, some of this cuts to people's identities. What they're really being asked, they think sometimes with these polls, is what camp are you in? What tribe are you in? What's your how do you identify yourself culturally? And I think that there are these forces today in society that drive polarization, as Brendan just said, on certain issues. So in evolution, it can be one of them. And for some communities, people don't want to be told that their religious beliefs are somehow incorrect because of what scientists say about evolution. And that there's some conflict there. But just to echo what Brendan said a second ago, everyone that I talked to for this National Geographic story talked about how important science was to them, how everyone loves science. I mean, science is the way we get to the truth about things. And I feel that it's worth noting that when I went to a creationism museum outside of San Diego, it's in Santee, California. It's a museum that presents the history of the world from the perspective of young Earth creationism, which is to say the whole Earth is only 6,000 years old, according to this museum. But it's filled with science. It's filled with the ideas and the terminology of science, because it doesn't just say, well, this is what Scripture says. Instead, it says, well, this is the evidence we have that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And it made me realize how science in some ways has won, in the sense that people know to win an argument or to win a debate, you have to win it in terms of evidence. What does the evidence show?
Well, except that the world is not 6,000 years old.
It is not. Well, right. Correct. The conclusion is wrong.
Let me raise some objections to that, Marty.
Well, go ahead, Brendan.
I was with Joel until that last part. I think the important distinction is between evidence winning the argument and evidence seeming to be important to marshal on your side. Right. So we all like to think that we respond to the evidence when we consider arguments, and it's important for the sides in these debates to seem to have the science on their side so that members of their tribe feel comfortable agreeing or disagreeing with a particular position. It's much less clear, though, that evidence is persuasive to people, at least when these issues become polarized. So in my own research, on a series of issues, from vaccines to climate change to whether there were WMDs in Iraq, we find again and again that how you view corrective information about those issues, which is often scientific or technical in some way, depends on your point of view. And so, you know, I think Joel's right that people are playing on a playing field that's established by science. It's important to go through, at least to seem to go through the process of marshaling evidence for your side. But whether people actually consider that in an open-minded way, I think, is a pretty different question.
Well, Brendan, let me pick up on that. So that if evidence or facts or statistics are not compelling reasons to get someone to change their mind, let's say on something like evolution, then how does one's mind get changed? If it is tribal, it's part of my identity, this is why I believe this, how do you get someone to consider another point of view?
Well, that's the big challenge. There's no magic answer. Some of these debates have been settled in the scientific community for decades or centuries, and yet the public is still in a different place. I do think it's important to move away from the assumption that facts and evidence are what will convince people. They can help, but in some cases, it's a strong consensus message from people in your tribe who you trust. So when every side of a debate is saying, we agree this is true, that is a very compelling message. That's a different message than when one side says the mm-hmm. earth is round and the other side says the earth is flat. So a good example actually is the idea that smoking causes cancer, which used to be controversial and is now overwhelmingly accepted by people across the spectrum, more than almost any of the other scientific views you've described earlier. Part of that is the overwhelming evidence, epidemiological, people's personal experience with relatives, testimony and transcripts from trials. But part of it is hearing it from all different sides, that eventually it became embarrassing to say that smoking didn't cause cancer, that you were denying something that was staring you in the face. And when people started hearing that from across the spectrum, that stopped being a view that people held. So that may be an exception. That may be a hard case to replicate, but I do think it is worth thinking about.
Does that make sense to you, Joel?
Yeah. Just to echo that, it's about trust. It's not about just the facts. I mean, the notion that some people need more facts to make up their mind seems to have been undercut by research on how do people make up their minds? How do they come to a conclusion about something? It's not from lack of information. They often begin with a conclusion in mind, and then they go out and find affirmation of it. Nowadays, particularly with the internet, you go on the internet and find out whatever you're looking for. There'll be someone out there saying, you know, you're right, your conclusion that you started with is the right conclusion. And the dynamics of the internet help create this confirmation bias, these sort of rabbit holes where people get in and everyone agrees with each other and they're not exposed to other views. But what Brendan said is exactly right. The way to overcome this is not to bombard people with more information, because by and large, they have a lot of information. It is to establish authorities who are trusted as honest brokers. And if you can build more trust in society and more trust in the sort of the consensus scientific mainstream view of some of these contentious issues, then you'll start to see maybe a narrowing of that gap between what the scientists believe on some of these issues and what the general public believes according to that Pew poll.
Brendan, about a minute before our break here, but do you see the internet as helpful to finding some kind of consensus, or does it create these kind of tribal camps where you go to find people's opinions that you share?
It probably doesn't help. I don't think we know the extent to which it's making the problem worse yet, because you could always go find confirmation of your views in other ways before. It's just we've reduced the cost a little bit. You don't have to go to the library. Now you can just turn on your phone and try to find that kind of affirmation if you'd like it. So it probably doesn't help. There's certainly the potential to make things worse and to enter into these kind of closed information loops that I think make us nervous about having a public debate where everyone's working from the same facts.
And that's Brendan Nyhan. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, and his research is focused on things like personal beliefs and misperceptions about politics, about healthcare. We're talking about science and the gap between scientists and the public on some very key issues. Also with us is Joel Achenbach. He's a writer for The Washington Post and author of the March cover story for National Geographic's magazine. It's called Why Do Many Reasonable People Doubt Science? You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Joel Achenbach and Brendan Nyhan about the divide, the gap between scientists and what many scientists believe and what the public believes, whether it's things like vaccines or GMOs or climate change or evolution. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Brendan, I want to put this tweet to you from Imri saying skepticism is a healthy part of science. The word you should be using is denial. How important are semantics? And you wrote about that recently.
That's right. You know, right. So it's the scientific approach is always to think of our conclusions as being tentative ones from a scientific standpoint, and to be skeptical of those and to question how strong they are. But at some point, as a society, we have to move forward based on the best evidence we have available. And the scientific process is the best way we have to reach those sorts of conclusions. And at that point, regardless of the remaining level of scientific uncertainty, if there is a scientific consensus, that's an important thing to recognize. Now, I should say, I'm not a huge fan of the denial term being applied across the board, and let me explain why.
Sure.
The concern is that linking these issues actually makes them more likely to be linked in people's minds. So if we start thinking of science denial as one phenomenon extending across these issues, which often have very diverse groups that are resisting the particular information in question, you may cause those folks to think of these issues as being part of a worldview and actually encourage more tribalism along these lines rather than less. And that's bad, right? The lesson from the dynamics that Joel and I have been describing is tribalism gets in the way of applying our critical faculties as a society to discerning the best available scientific evidence. So if people start attacking science denial across the board, some people are going to look at those people attacking the science deniers and say, I'm not like them. I must be on the other side of this issue. And that's a terrible dynamic and not one we should encourage.
Yeah, go ahead, Joel.
Yeah, there's I've been getting a lot of emails on this exact issue because I think in my story I have a reference in the National Geographic story to climate change skeptics, and people say, well, hang on, those are deniers. Those aren't skeptics. And Justin Gillis of the New York Times had a very good article about this recently about, well, what do you call someone who doesn't believe in the consensus view on climate change? The problem with deniers, I'm not a big fan of that word, and I hadn't heard of the objection that Brendan just raised, which is an interesting one about linking these different issues. Some people consider it just a pejorative, and it has an echo of Holocaust denial. But as Justin Gillis pointed out in the Times, that it also lumps everyone together in a single label who might have different levels of disagreement with or rejection of the consensus view. And I don't think we've quite sorted out what to do about the nomenclature there. And I don't think it's a giant issue, but I have been hearing a lot from people on that who are concerned, because obviously skepticism is good in it. You know, for most scientists are skeptics. I mean, the great defenders of science, you know, may read the Skeptical Inquirer magazine or Skeptic magazine, and doubt in general. Doubt is a very important tool in science. So we have to figure out how to talk about this still, I guess.
Well, Brendan, and I wonder whether it raises questions about when you disagree with someone, calling them names. I mean, I guess denier can have some negative connotations. When the whole vaccine issue came up a couple of weeks ago, you know, people that oppose vaccines were called stupid by some people, you know, anti-vaxxers. Does that also sort of build resistance to being open to other ideas if you're being called negative names?
Very much so. I do think that there's unfortunately some overlap between the people who've been most vocal about applying the denier label widely and the people who've been most aggressive and inflammatory towards people, for instance, people who haven't given their children all of the recommended vaccines. And let me be perfectly clear. I think you should give your children all of the recommended vaccines. But the concern is that if you berate people, if you call them names, if you accuse them of acting with ill will towards others, as some people do, that's just going to push people away. It's going to polarize the issue. And again, the folks who are being attacked are going to say, well, I'm not part of this group of people who's attacking me is casting me out. We actually want to bring those folks into the social consensus. Like if you take, for instance, parents who don't give all the recommended vaccines, those are overwhelmingly parents who are trying to do the right thing for their children. These are well-meaning folks. They may not have come to the right conclusion from the perspective of public health, but we want to bring them into that social consensus, not push them out. And I fear that the urge to express people's emotions about these issues, which is itself a kind of a manifestation of the polarization we see, could be counterproductive.
And is that where a trusted person, whoever's trusted by people who oppose vaccines, could change their mind, Brendan?
I hope so. I hope so. I've argued, for instance, that your family doctor would be the most effective messenger about vaccines. In my own research, I found that information about the scientific evidence debunking myths about vaccines doesn't change people's minds. It can actually make the more hesitant parents less likely to vaccinate a future child rather than more. And a doctor who they trust might be more effective, or a community member, or a religious leader, or someone they respect at their place of business. There's if we can work through intermediaries who are trusted and communicate the strength of that scientific consensus, I think that can be more effective than actually putting that science in front of people directly.
Joel, I'm looking at a piece. It was actually in the New York Times yesterday about a scientist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, a scientist named Wei-Hak Sun. And as it turned out, based on some of the reporting at the Times, he has accepted more than $1.2 million in money from fossil fuel industry. He has testified before Congress. He has been interviewed. He has been viewed as an expert. Which raises the question, and I do remember in the early days of the anti-smoking campaign, doctors telling people it was healthy to smoke. So when you have scientists and health people who are giving either misinformation or loaded information, how does the public wrestle with that?
Well, in this specific case, this researcher did not disclose to his superiors where he was getting his money, and there's a certainly a whiff here of the possibility that he was being a charlatan, or he was being paid to spread disinformation, and that he's a disinformation agent. I don't know all the specifics of it. I have not reported that story, but
right.
I did see the piece in the Times, and it was kind of a bombshell, because here's someone who had been cited by certain people. I think James Inhofe, the senator who famously has declared global warming to be a hoax, a huge scientific fraud, he says, and he's the a very influential senator. He has cited this researcher in his statements in Congress. And so one aspect of this issue that we haven't really talked about on the show so far is that there are people who are actively spreading disinformation, or who, for whatever reason, have an axe to grind, or they're not being honest about what the research shows, and so that's a factor in this. I think, and Brendan, tell me if you disagree. I don't think that's what has driven the big divide here, or I don't think that's the main problem. And I think it's an element of the problem, but I don't think disinformation alone can explain what is the dynamic that we see, for example, on the vaccines issue.
Do you agree with that, Brendan?
Well, it varies. It varies. There's a supply side and a demand side of misinformation, unfortunately. There are entrepreneurial folks out there who will anticipate or seek out the willing audience that's often available for misleading or fraudulent claims. Wakefield was the name of the doctor who created the autism myth about vaccines, and he was very much this kind of entrepreneur, and his research was so fraudulent that he was stripped of his medical license, and the article was retracted, but the damage lingers. Now, that found such a willing audience that he's still riding within the anti-vaccine movement. And you can see similar dynamics on political issues. Climate change.
But Brendan, do you think?
Hold on. Yeah, just finish your thought, Brendan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Climate change didn't used to be such a polarized issue until it got mapped into the political space. And it was mapped into the political space by politicians who saw it as lining up with their worldview. And that, unfortunately, created the kind of dynamics we've seen over the last few decades.
Go ahead, Joel.
I was just wondering if you thought that Wakefield believes what he's saying.
What he said or what – I mean that
he's – Yeah, what he said. Cause Wakefield, he published this thing in 1998 in the Lancet, and it got retracted later about vaccines. I'm just wondering if this is something he still believes, or if it's just that he's got a market to purvey that viewpoint.
Do you know the answer to that, Brendan?
No, well, so actually, this is an important point in this debate. I don't know what he thinks, and actually, we can't know. But we have to take them at their word. So I think it's less important to worry about how sincere they are, and more important to just hold people responsible for making accurate statements in public, whatever their intentions. I'm happy to assume his intentions are good, and he believes these things are true. But the evidence says he's wrong, and actually it doesn't matter what his intentions are. He's objectively misinforming people every time he makes these statements in public. So I think and actually I want to, you know, Marty, if I can just add a point here.
Sure.
I was talking about the need to be tolerant to parents and members of the public who are misinformed. I think we should be intolerant of people, elites, who go out in public on national media and international media and mislead thousands or millions of people. Those people are too easily given a platform, and there aren't enough reputational incentives against that kind of behavior. It won't get rid of the demand for the kinds of misinformation that they're sometimes purveying, but at least can make it more costly for people to go out and provide that. And I think that's something that the media could do a better job.
I was going to say, do you hold the media responsible for that, for giving people who have been discredited just too much of a platform?
Sure. Well, let me give you a perfect example. There was a woman named Betsy McCoy who created the principal myth around the Clinton health care reform bill, which was that it would prevent you from getting medical services with a doctor of your choosing, even if you paid on your own. Okay, that was false. It was explicitly ruled out by the legislation, but it was a major factor in the debate over that health care law. Fast forward 15 years from the Clinton health care law to the Obama health care law, and she helped create the myth that eventually morphed into the death panels claim. She was one of the first people to make baseless claims that the Affordable Care Act would force euthanasia on seniors based on a misinterpretation of a clause. She was running back the exact same playbook, and the media, you know, fell for it. And, you know, now here we are still talking about death panels, which, you know, is something that has its roots in part in a claim she made in 2009. So I do think we can do a much better job, because the damage that these myths can create, you know, as we see with vaccines or healthcare, can linger for years or decades.
I have a tweet for you, Joel, from Michael. He says, what are the two gentlemen, that would be the two of you, what are your views about, I'm not a scientist, this trend in politics, especially as it relates to climate change? And we do hear that, and some people are scientists, some people aren't. But does that seem like people sort of like allowing themselves to say anything because they're not a scientist?
Well, I think they're dodging the issue. They don't want to be in a situation of denying the best science publicly. But they also don't want to – they know that in their political base, there is a – on some of these issues, particularly climate change, there's such a partisan divide that they don't want to alienate people in their political base. And so they're trying to have it both ways. I mean, most of us are not – scientists, but we understand the need to build policy around what does the scientific community say is the most plausible situation. And I want to make one quick note about that specific issue of climate change, is that it did not used to be such a partisan, you know, ideologically fraught issue, that climate change got kind of swept into the whirlpool of politics over time. If you go back to the 90s, there was not such a sharp divide, depending on if you were liberal or conservative or Republican or Democrat or whatever. And I remember distinctly when John McCain ran for president in 2007, he was campaigning in New Hampshire. This is well into this century. He was campaigning in New Hampshire, and part of his stump speech was, we have to do something about global warming. Mm-hmm. He thought he could get the Republican nomination with that as his as part of his platform, and eventually he dropped that because he wasn't getting the reaction he wanted. But over time, some of these issues become more and more fraught with politics. And just to follow up, one other thing about what Brendan said about the media, he said the media can be doing a better job on some of these things. I totally agree. You know, I work in the media. I'm a newspaper reporter. One interesting thing that's happened in the last 30, 40 years is you see the sort of the disintegration of the media. What is the media now? There's so many sources of information. It's not just Walter Cronkite on the evening news anymore, and it's not just the Washington Post or National Geographic. There's so many sources of information that the term the media it covers a lot of people.
Mm. And again, almost up on a break here, Brendan, but I'm going to go back to you. And I wonder with the climate change science whether it's also scary. If you think about a sea level rise and the fact that people could be losing their homes and some of the scary scenarios that we hear from people who are experts when it comes to climate change, how much do you think that affects people's belief systems because they just do not want to believe it because it means they're going to have to change their lifestyle?
Yeah, I mean, it hits a lot of psychological weak spots. We don't want to pay, in particular, we don't want to pay short-term costs for long-term gains, particularly long-term gains that are spread over the whole planet. And it may entail solutions that are not only uncomfortable for all of us, given the lifestyles we live here in the United States, but are especially uncomfortable depending on your ideological point of view. So there's some research that talks about what's called solution aversion, that the policies we might have to enact to address climate change are much more uncomfortable than the actual scientific finding itself. And there are some places that have focused on more short-term mitigation approaches and tried to minimize polarization. I would say with mixed success, but people are trying at the local level because if you live in a place like Miami, climate change is a day-to-day issue. It's not a long-term issue. It's not an ideological issue. It's a how do we keep water off the streets issue, or it's going to be soon. And that's maybe a different way to have the conversation.
And that's Brendan Nyhan, who joins us along with Joel Achenbach. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I see a lot of people want to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. How do we choose which science to believe, which to question? Washington Post science writer Joel Achenbach explores this question in his new National Geographic article titled Why Do Many Reasonable People Doubt Science? Also with us is Dartmouth College professor Brendan Nyhan, and he studies how people develop opinions and attitudes about things like healthcare and science and politics. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Greg from, looks like, Swedesboro, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Great show today.
Thank you.
Just on the point that politicians claiming they're not scientists, and anyone claiming they're not a scientist, if you hold a bachelor's degree, you've been taught citation and you've been taught to analyze evidence. So that's really no excuse to be ignorant on any kind of subject. Thanks very much.
Okay, fair enough. Do you agree with that, Joel?
Yeah, I think that that on some of these issues, the scientists are just dodging it. They're just – I mean, not scientists. The politicians are just dodging the issue. And that you don't – the thing about science is not in the business of absolute truths. Science is in the business of trying to approach the best approximation of the truth. And everything is contingent upon the next experiment or the next study. But in the meantime, as in this long march towards understanding nature, sometimes you have to make a policy decision based on what's the most plausible, likely scenario. And you can't constantly, defer those decisions. We pay the politicians money to make policies and to do things and not just say, well, no one really knows for sure, or the science is too vague, or I don't know. I mean, that's their job, is to take actions based on the best available evidence.
I have an email from Allison. She says several things, including Americans have a cultural conviction that there are two sides to every story and everyone is entitled to an opinion. Brendan Nyhan, because you look at people's opinions and personal beliefs, is that part of the problem, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, well, it's tricky because you can feed into a mentality that that you're denying any possibility that you could be wrong,
right.
And that can make people suspicious. It's a kind of conspiratorial mentality that can sometimes arise when you say, well, the scientific evidence is overwhelming on this issue. At some point in the public, we have to, you know, we're no longer debating whether the Earth is flat. We've accepted that and moved on. And there are other issues where the scientific evidence is getting towards that level, but the public debate continues because there's such a demand to be fair to both sides. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention the political pressures and commercial pressures to do that. It's not just that interpersonally we expect both sides to be represented. It's if you have an audience where half of your listeners or viewers might be alienated if you didn't pay deference to their side of a particular debate, that puts enormous pressure on media outlets and other kinds of institutions to represent those views, even if the scientific evidence is not 50-50. And I should just say, as a last point, that in representing those views, you can further mislead people. If you see one skeptic, there's experimental evidence, if you see one skeptic about climate change or denier, whatever you want to call them, someone who dissents from the scientific consensus on climate change, that significantly decreases people's perceptions of the level of scientific consensus in the scientific community more broadly, just showing one. So these decisions to represent both sides do really matter.
And I wonder, Joel, whether scientists want to engage the public and know how to engage the public on some of these issues, and whether they could do a better job. If we're seeing this divide, seems to me part of this responsibility does fall on the shoulders of scientists, broadly speaking.
Well, absolutely, and this is one of the big hot issues in the community right now, is what should scientists do? What is, if you're a scientist, what should you do about the so-called science communication problem? And I think the big split is over the issue of advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
Should you just be a source of neutral information, or should you go further than that and actually advocate certain policies? And I was on a panel just the other day at the big meeting in San Jose of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and one of the scientists there from Stanford said that she believed that the role should be, you should be an informational expert but not a prescriptive advocate for specific policies. But other people disagree on that. I'd be curious to know what Brendan thinks actually works. I mean, the question I have is what's the empirical evidence that you get a better outcome if a scientist goes beyond just the bare facts that his or her research shows and is more of an advocate? Is there evidence that actually works in promoting public understanding?
Yeah, I'm curious about that too. Brendan, go ahead.
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I've seen that exact study design. I think what I would say is that scientific recommendations for policy could be effective, but it's going to depend on how much trust you put in that scientist, which is, of course, the problem that is hanging up a lot of these debates in the first place. And as a political scientist, I should say, I'm very sympathetic to the view that the science doesn't tell us what the right policy is. The right policy, you know, there are technical constraints that science can provide, for instance, on, you know, how you might or might not mitigate climate change. But the values trade-offs that are inherent in the choices that we make about addressing climate change have no right answer. There is no scientific answer to how we make those sorts of values trade-offs. And so I think it's important to for scientists to be circumspect about the limits of their technical knowledge and the fact that it doesn't necessarily dictate the exact policy prescription that we might use.
We have an interesting email from Paul. He says, does it look like the new Pope, who seems to be friendly to science, will have an appreciable influence to counteract those who oppose it? Things like climate change. Interesting to think about the Pope in the context of our conversation, Joel.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm certainly curious to hear more from him when he comes to the States. I guess it's later this year,
yeah.
Correct? But I don't know the answer to that.
Have you thought about that, Brendan?
No, but it's an interesting question. I mentioned earlier how that kind of convergent evidence of scientific consensus is powerful. And, I think when a religious leader is acknowledging the strength of that scientific consensus, that's maybe a stronger signal, a different kind of signal than you might get when you just hear about another scientific study. One thing we haven't talked about specifically is that the scientific community has become both empirically, it's both actually true and perceived to be more liberal and overwhelmingly democratic than it used to be. And we can talk about why that is, but it does create a kind of credibility problem on some of these more partisan or ideological issues. So having other kinds of messengers who aren't lined up with one side of the American political divide, like the Pope, could be constructive and I think could maybe break us out of these stale debates.
We could do a whole hour on this, but just a quick follow-up, Brendan. Why do you think more scientists are either affiliated with or seen as affiliated with the Democratic Party or with liberal ideas?
It has to do with some of these issues, I think, have pushed some scientists away. The academy has become more liberal. There's a kind of push-pull element to it. I don't know specifically. There's a certain group of people with postgraduate education who've become more consistently Democratic, just as other kinds of groups have become more consistently Republican. And scientists have fallen into that category. And again, it didn't used to be true. My parents' generation was around at the time when university students were occupying scientific labs to protest the Vietnam War or to object to doing research for the Defense Department, right? That was and those kinds of the allegiances of the professors on campus now are not seen that way, I would say, overwhelmingly at the nation's top research universities. So, it's a real problem. I mean, we do need more perspectives in the scientific community so we have those credible messengers and it's not seen as simply a reflection of people's ideology. I don't think it actually is, but it does create a perception problem that's difficult to overcome.
Let me see what Howard from Lambertville has to say. Howard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Sure.
Great debate, guys.
Thank you.
A long time ago in the debate, maybe half an hour ago, I think maybe Joel said that the scientific process was the best way. But I'm very conscious that scientists have a very narrow focus in what they do. And the rest of the world, has to deal with issues in a multi-discipline form. The rest of the world have the internet and are much better informed than we ever were before. And sometimes the scientific view is too narrow.
Well, that's an interesting
doesn't consider the whole picture.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, Joel. Let me give you a chance to respond to Howard's comment.
Yeah, I think it's a great comment. I think that the world that we're creating, that we are actively engineering, with 7 billion people going to 9 billion people, it's a highly networked world. It's a digital world. Is shaped by science and shaped by technology, but you can't let just the engineers make all the decisions about what that world is going to be like, and you have to bring into the conversation people from the humanities and from the religious leaders and say, well, what should this world be like? I mean, how can it be just and fair and beautiful and a safe space for people to live the lives they want to live, and that goes way beyond purely scientific or technical issues, and it involves values. And so I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, Howard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have a comment it's a tweet from Lib saying, why are you avoiding talking about Fox News' outright lies? Talk about the need to call people out. Brendan, do you see it that way?
As soon as we turn this into a debate about Fox News, all the polarization dynamics we've talked about return. Has Fox News...
I was wondering about that. Yes. No, go ahead.
Been inaccurate in how it reports about science? Sure, I think there's certainly evidence on that. Are they the cause of a lot of this stuff? No, I think they're the most visible manifestation of some of the problems we've been talking about for the issues that are partisan or ideological, which isn't all of them. But they're visible. They're on people's TV. If you sit home and turn on the TV and you want to see these dynamics playing out, that's the kind of place you could see it, or increasingly on MSNBC. So I don't want to blame cable news any more than I want to blame the internet. I think that's probably too simple, but it's certainly a reflection of these dynamics, and it may contribute.
Mm-hmm. And Joel, from your reporting and from your interviews, do you see kind of a way forward where there can be a reasonable discussion about some of these issues we've been talking about, where people can be open to have their minds, if not entirely changed, to be open to ideas that might feel a little alien to them?
I think it's a long-term project that involves schools and teaching people from an early age how to assess information, how to weigh information and weigh competing claims, and to say, well, what is this based on? How do they know this? Is this reliable? Is this peer-reviewed information? Is this just one study? Is it a small study set? Is the source of this, are they credible? I think teaching people how to think about complex issues starts at an early age, and to help people with their critical thinking. I don't think there's a quick fix to it. Well, we could have the same conversation, Marty, probably 20 years from now.
Oh, don't say that. I'll be dead by then.
No.
But let me ask you, Brent, I mean, does it go back to educate? Do we need to figure out how to educate the public better to be able to think about things that might be a challenge to their belief system, but at least allow them to be open to them?
I'd like to think so. I'm in education. I certainly try to help my students be as open-minded as they can be. But the evidence actually suggests that sometimes education helps us have more consistent views and to better align our beliefs about the world with the values and principles that we support. So in some cases, education is associated with more polarization on these issues, not less. So I guess I'm hesitant to put too much stock in that as a solution. We've thought for a long time, if we just educated the public more, they would know everything they need to know to participate in public life. That's been the dream of civic reformers for more than 100 years. And we're a lot more educated, but the American public still doesn't know that much about science or politics, and that's okay. People have better things to do. Honestly, we don't all need to be scientists. To go back to our earlier conversation, what we need are institutions that effectively transmit that scientific evidence into the policymaking process in exactly the way Joel described, so we can use the best available evidence to make choices as a society. And to have expert communities that can speak credibly about this evidence to people wherever they are on whatever issue it is. And they shouldn't be the last word, but those facts and that evidence can be an important part of the conversation.
Well, we have to end our conversation. My thanks to the two of you, Brendan Nyhan and Joel Achenbach. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times. Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, and his research focuses on things like personal beliefs and misperceptions. Brendan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
And Joel Achenbach, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And you can read his cover story in the National Geographic edition, the March edition of National Geographic, Why Do Many Reasonable People Doubt Science? And he is a science writer for The Washington Post. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.